content of this program is intended for people who are blind and or print impaired. Hi, everybody. This is Evan Mercer for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I will read to you from the New Yorker magazine. From the fiction section of the January 18, 2021 issue of the New Yorker magazine, Blushes by Graham Swift. Dr. Cole eased his car from his garage, then stopped, out of habit, to watch in his rearview mirror the garage door slide gently down and the light above it extinguish itself. This had once given him an absurd, vain satisfaction. Now it was his only goodbye. The car was expensive and comfortable, as was the house that went with it, large, sedate, islanded in lawns and leafage, like the others in the discreet crescent. As he drove off, the purr of the engine and the crackle of gravel were the only sounds, except for, though inside his car he couldn't hear it, the grand, great anthem of birds. It was a little after six on an April morning, but at eight it would still be astonishingly quiet, except for the birds. They had become extraordinarily loud, as if by some conscious effort. But that was an illusion. It was the contrast with the silence. Less than an hour ago, he'd been lying in bed, listening to them and marveling, a solitary man in a big house, surrounded, hemmed by birds. And the roads, even the main ones, would be empty. They would be just as empty at eight. The phrase ghost town sometimes came to Dr. Cole as he made the journey. Ghost world. He would reach the hospital within 15 minutes. Normally, when had normally ceased to apply, it might take 45. As he turned out of the driveway, a fox slipped nonchalantly through the beam of his headlights. One morning he had counted six foxes. The birds and the foxes, they had reclaimed the world. This journey was his time not just for counting foxes, but for thought, or rather his corridor for memories, which came thick and fast, unbidden. Ghosts. He had proved what was commonly said, that when we are old, it is our earliest recollections that return to us most pressingly, while the latter stuff recedes. The latter stuff could be soberly condensed. Two marriages, one divorce, no children in either marriage, and the second much longer and more meaningful than the first. His second wife had been the love of his life. He could say that without hesitation. But she'd been dead now for most of 2 years. The loss of his life. She died only a year after he retired. For a while, they'd lain together in the bed in which he'd just been lying alone, listening, as dawn broke, to the birds. She'd said to him once softly, "We can do this now." As if lying there together were the simplest but greatest gift retirement could bring. It was. Despite or because of the empty roads, he'd begun to leave earlier than he needed to, so that he could deliberately dawdle, even take detours, to permit the gush of memory to run its course. It was memory, not thought. His mind simply filled and throbbed, a function of driving. He vaguely rejoiced in the peaceful roads that allowed it to happen. That word, too, came to him. Peace. In a little while, he would enter a scene of war. He had come forward. How could he not? He was 72 and retired, but how could he not? He was a specialist in respiratory disease. He had retired shortly after his mother had died. She was 92. Decades ago, after his parents' divorce, it was his mother who'd want him to be a doctor. It was his mother who'd almost exclusively claimed him, and he hadn't resisted. He had become not just a doctor, but, as it turned out, a top man in his field. So he'd fulfilled his mother's dream, and more. A top man in medicine, but he hadn't been able to save her, or his wife. Within 2 years, they were both gone. the women of his life. He'd come forward. It was hardly a choice. He'd come forward like a called-up reservist. They'd been honored to have him back. But what did that mean amid such havoc? A queue of casualties, a queue of deaths, one of which he clearly understood might be his own. All of them understood it. It might be any one of them. What they didn't know, as he strove to be a figure of cool authority, was that he actually liked being there. It took the mind off, as they say. It gave him something to do. Except now, it took the mind off in a different way. It didn't happen on the journeys home. He did his extendable, unquantifiable shift. He found something to eat. He drove home, numb. He slept. Thank goodness he could sleep. It was only here, on those dawn rides, that his life returned to him from its wondrous distances. Otherwise, it had departed. It had seemed already over. And now he understood, accepted, that soon it might be truly over. As he held the wheel, he was a child again. If it were a matter of calculation, he could say with exactness that he was 10. But he didn't have to calculate. He was 10. He was 10. And he was lying in bed on a sunny June morning because he was ill. He saw his mother's face as she leaned toward him. She was sitting on the end of his bed now, and then stroking his covered foot or knee. And though he was ill, her face didn't look in the least bit troubled. It looked full of gladness, and even quite merry. She would have been, what, a woman in her early 30s. And Dr. Henderson's face? Dr. Henderson. Though it was the face of a doctor, and therefore provisionally grave, also looked quite merry. This always happened when he visited. Doctors visited in those days. He would loom in the doorway, holding his doctor's bag, a forbidding figure. More often than not, still in his black winter coat and bringing with him a residue of chilly air. But very quickly, he would melt and become friendly, even jolly. And how old would he have been? In his late 30s? A young doctor. Now he would be dead, of course. But on this morning, Dr. Henderson wore a pale gray lightweight summer suit. He sat down at the bedside on the chair that was always provided for him. It wasn't part of the bedroom furniture. His mother would fetch it. The chair for Dr. Henderson. He could see it now. It had striped upholstery, red on cream, and he later learned that the stripes were called Regency stripes. Its usual place was in his parents' room, where it seemed not to be used for sitting on, since when he looked, it was nearly always draped with items of his parents' clothing. So now, Dr. Henderson sat where his parents' clothes had mingled. But even before he sat, even as he crossed the room, he said, "Well, Jimmy, you're a lucky man. You could have been poorly on your 10th birthday. Many happy returns, if I'm not too late. Your mother tells me you had a wonderful birthday party. Okay, let's take a look at you." The doctor sat on the chair. His mother sat on the bed. This was how it always was. There was no question of it being the other way around. His mother stroked his foot or knee and sometimes leaned toward him, and Dr. Henderson bent over him in his professional way. Each time, lying there, he'd have the thought, but keep it to himself, that they were like a little family. They were like the little group of three that normally lived in this house. And suppose his father, who was now busy at work, were to be suddenly replaced by Dr. Henderson. Would it be so terrible? Dr. Henderson had a way, though at 10 he didn't yet have the word for it, of being fatherly. Was Dr. Henderson even more fatherly than his own father? His mother's face was so bright and glad, and there seemed this morning to flutter around them all a particular kind of glee. He knew what it was. He felt it himself, even though he was unwell. It seemed that he had now completed the list of illnesses that, though they were illnesses, it was highly desirable he should have. It was like a duty that had taken, in his case, 10 years, his whole life. Each illness was challenging, one or two were nasty, but at the same time, a strange sort of pride and pleasure. Now he'd done them all. He was to be congratulated, and not just for his recent birthday. And as he lay there, ill, the object of his mother's and Dr. Henderson's attention, he felt a strange surge of happiness. Even the word happy seemed to hover over him, like Dr. Henderson's not-yet-conferred diagnosis, like something that might hover over him all his life. "Well, Jimmy, I'd say by the look of you, your mother was quite right. She'll be doing my job next. Mind you, as illnesses go, it's not one of the hardest to spot." Dr. Henderson gave his mother a quick glance that might have been called cheeky. It was a glance, a nice glance. His mother often used the word cheeky, usually about her son. "Don't be cheeky." And now it would have been particularly appropriate. Dr. Henderson said, "Scarlet fever. I'd say so, too." Then his mother, with a sly kind of smile, "Unless he's just blushing." Dr. Henderson couldn't have known what special meaning this had. If his mother had been given to winking, she might at this point have winked. Dr. Henderson gave a half snort, half laugh. "So what have you got to blush about, young man? Open wide." And how clever of him to ask such a question and then taken away the meanings of answering it. The question floated off into the air as Dr. Henderson inspected his tongue and tonsils. "Scarlet fever, no doubt about it. Let's have a look at your rash." As he drove now between rows of tomb-like houses, he remembered his little pajama top, striped like the chair, but in softer colors. And he remembered his rash, the creepy feeling of it, and how long after it had gone away and he was otherwise well, his skin was still strange and rough. And he remembered the whole list, of which this, in his case, was the last, of those childhood illnesses with their names that they were themselves faintly childish and fairy tale-like, as if invented for infant use. Measles, mumps, chicken pox, whooping cough. All of them to be undergone and then left behind, usually forever. Like little piles of children's clothes that were no longer needed. Like miniature versions of the clothes on the chair in his parents' bedroom. Children everywhere went through it. The illnesses had once been perilous and in some cases still were, and could even potentially kill. When he was smaller, there had been still the real frightener, polio. Though, that had been simply dealt with one morning by a jab in his arm. Frightening enough, but he hadn't cried. And his mother then, too, had looked particularly glad, though it was a different kind of gladness. There was even a slight wetness in her eye. It was all over. Polio dealt with, and you didn't even have to lie in bed for 2 days. A jab in the arm. It meant you could never get it because you'd had it already, in a manner of speaking. His mother had tried to explain. It was called vaccination. Another fox. In the dim light, you couldn't see their faces or even their reddish fur, but he always had the impression that they were wearing a sneer. His bedroom curtains had been half closed, a ritual of sickness. His mouth was silenced again by the insertion of a thermometer. Dr. Henderson, armed by his mother's prior diagnosis, produced medicines from his bag and gave his mother some words of instruction. Two of the pills were to be taken immediately. He wrote a supplementary prescription, and then he removed the thermometer, looked at it, wiped it carefully, and put it back into a little liquid-filled tube. "It's a mild case, Jimmy. You hardly have a temperature. I've seen much, much worse. You'll live. You'll be right as rain in a few days if you do as your mother says. And no school for at least a week." "You'll live. As for blushing, young man, I can't cure that. You'll have to take care of that by yourself." He tightened his lips, both serious and not, and then, snapping his bag shut, he got up from his chair and looked at his watch. Your mother's promised me a cup of tea. Dr. Henderson was always offered a cup of tea. His mother got up, too, and they stood together at his bedside, as if he were their child. Dr. Henderson said, And no playing with your friends, either. But you've already done that. A wonderful birthday party. You're lucky you didn't miss it. I'm sorry I missed it myself. They went downstairs, leaving him with the sudden thought that Dr. Henderson might never enter his bedroom again, if this was the last illness. And then with the thought, not so stabbing yet puzzling, why should Dr. Henderson be sorry to have missed his party? Had he been invited? That party, even the hypothetical presence at it of Dr. Henderson. Though why, indeed, should he have been there? Why should he have been standing there a special guest among the gaggle of mums? The mums were the only grown-ups at the party. There were no men. It was a tea-time party. All the men were absent at work. All the fathers. All the doctors, too. But it was true. It was a wonderful party. It re-enveloped him now. The best of his birthday parties because, after all, he was 10. A big boy. Two numbers to his name. And the best party because, but this he knew now was hindsight. Neither a thing nor a word he had had then. In less than a year's time, his parents would start the process of not living together. The world would disintegrate. It wasn't his mother and Dr. Henderson, as he might have supposed, even vaguely wished. His mother sometimes went to see Dr. Henderson by herself. But this was only to see her doctor in his surgery. Women's stuff, his father had once baffingly said about these visits, and then shrugged as if he didn't care. Putting two and two together, he'd wondered if this stuff might have to do with the little brother or sister he'd once been promised. But surely that was all finished with long ago, long before he was 10. His mother had settled for just one. So had he settled on being the one. It was his mother and him. Then he dared to suppose that the visits might not be anything medical at all. But it had been his father. It had been the other way around. When his father went to work, he didn't sometimes just go to work. Though none of this had clouded his 10th birthday party, no more than had the illness he would have a week later. A wonderful party on a gorgeous summer's day in the garden that lay beneath his bedroom window. If he'd got up from his sick bed, he might have surveyed the scene of his party. But he didn't need to. It was in his head. As it was in his head now. The lawn strewn with his guests, his school friends. Only an hour before, they'd all been at school, and the lawn had been just a lawn, quietly basking in the June sun. But a transformation had occurred. The boys, including himself, had been thrust into clean shirts, and the girls, more willingly, perhaps, into party frocks. Then they'd all regathered at his house and taken possession of the lawn. On the narrow terrace between house and lawn stood a table bearing food and drink, and round it clustered the mums in party frocks of their own. Under the table, hidden by a tablecloth hanging to the ground, had been, though not for long, everything needed for a succession of party games, and the presents to go with them. Everyone, he understood, was to have presents, but he would have the most and the best. And so it had transpired. What was on the table was soon pillaged. The tablecloth would eventually need a serious wash, and what was underneath achieved its purpose. The lawn became strewn not just with children, but with torn and crumpled wrapping paper and other debris from the games. Not to mention many smeared and sticky paper plates and cups, some trodden on. And all this joyous litter was a tribute to his mother's toil. How she must have labored that day, preparing little fancy cakes and one big one, as well as ice cream, jellies, bottles of lemonade, jugs of lemon and orange squash to be topped up with ice cubes from the new fridge. In the brief interval between his return from school and the start of it all, he had watched her set everything out with unpanicky efficiency, a calm smile on her face. How she must have worked, wrapping the presents as well, and how unflappably and triumphantly she had assembled the results of her work. In the unit, soon, he would inwardly invoke, to assert his necessary poise, his mother's busy serenity before his 10th birthday party. At the last moment, she'd gone up quickly to her bedroom to put on her own party frock. She reappeared in a dress that was a mass of swirling red blooms on white and in a delicate waft of perfume. Her day dress would have been left on the Regency chair. Then the front doorbell began to ring. He saw it all now as he drove toward what was no party at all. The children in charge of the lawn, the women subserviently but floridly in charge of the table, dispensing the food and drink and stepping onto the grass, some in unsuitably high heels, only to deal with the games and the crucial issue of presents. The names of some of his friends, his party guests, came clearly back to him, though he had not thought of them for decades. Bobby Scott, Nigel Wilson, Helen Fletcher, Wendy Sims. They were all on the lawn. Where were they now? A party for both children and mums, an invisible wavering line between the two. But there was a moment when the mothers all claimed him. They drew him away from his pride of place on the lawn and took him aside. And they said things like, "You mustn't forget us, Jimmy," or, "Let's have some of you, too." It was Mrs. Sims who had said that. "Let's have some of you, too." Whatever it meant. She said it after popping into her mouth, almost whole, one of the little cakes. And as she did so, her eyes bulged and goggled in exactly the same way that her daughters did when she attempted the same. She flicked away bits of cake from her lips and then waggled her fingers in the air. Her party dress was flowery. They were in a garden, after all, and had no sleeves and a deep collar. When she brushed her mouth, a sizable crumb fell into her neckline and disappeared. Did she know? Did she see that he saw? But she said, after the waggly thing, "Let's have some of you, too, Jimmy," and added, "Us girls, too." So all the mums were now girls. It was confusing. And then she said, which was even more confusing, "So come on, Jim, you've got to tell us." Her eyes swiveled around the crowded room, lawn. "You can tell us. Which one do you like best? Which one is your favorite?" Then, as if to correct herself, she said, "Which party frock?" More and more confusion. Did she really mean, as he'd momentarily thought, which girl? Or did she mean which frock? Or was it one and the same? In order to give an answer, did he have to separate the girls from their frocks? Which was the thought. Did he have an answer anyway? So he said nothing. He struggled, a magnet for confusion. Was Mrs. Sims really wanting him to choose her daughter, Wendy, both frock and girl? Then another mom, was it Mrs. Scott, chimed in, "He's blushing." Worse and worse. But his mother quickly and gently said, "Leave him alone. Let him be. It's his party." It wasn't reproachful of the other women. It was just a little soft statement that at once rescued him. He felt again now, a 72-year-old man at the wheel of a car, its protective touch winging to him like a bird. And had he immediately stopped blushing? How could he know? And perhaps no one knew, not even Mrs. Sims, that he was blushing not at the choice put to him, but at the thought of that crumb that had dropped down her dress. Where had it gone? And at the thought of all these grown-up party dresses, rustling, pressing, and whispering around him, which had been put on in more complicated ways than the girls' ones. And it was at least partly true to say, especially for him. For a moment, he'd been claimed by the women, even made to feel he belonged to them, and been made to understand that they were also girls. And for a moment, too, after his mother's magical intervention, he'd even seemed to see everything through their eyes. Not just the spectacle of the party, of the child-sprinkled lawn, which supposedly still guarded his secret choice, but everything, everything all around. Not just the lawn, but the rest of the garden and the adjoining gardens, all with their own lawns and trellises and cascades of roses and apple trees and clumps of hydrangea bushes. And the houses with their red-tiled roofs and glinting windows, many of them flung open as if to draw a delighted breath on this scintillating afternoon. He let his eyes sweep round, the way their eyes, he saw, now and then swept giddily around to take it all in. Everything. The houses, he had once been told, were roughly the same age as him. They'd been new when his parents moved in, the homes of pioneers. Now they were settled and established and 10 years old, but still had an aura of newness, just like him. Inside the houses were new fridges, new televisions. Though not inside or even outside them on this radiant day were all the fathers who, but had he thought this then, were working like billy-o to pay for it all, to keep the whole sublime fabric intact. Why should Dr. Henderson have been invited? Here and among the gardens were tall, massive trees, their leaves green-gold in the afternoon light, left over from wherein it had been farmland, hedgerows, and fields. A farmhouse and barns had once stood where his primary school was now. It was hard to believe. He looked round and could even see how, to the mums, it must look like heaven. Everything they'd once wished and hoped for. It was heaven. And they'd achieved it, as they'd achieved their children and watched them grow, as they'd achieved this party. If he didn't see it then, he saw it now, a dazzling homage to it all. He saw that it was happiness. What else? He gasped, holding the wheel, at the sweet breath of it all, a 72-year-old man driving between heaven and hell. He gasped and recognized that this was his chosen field, the breath of life. Breath. And why do we blush? Why are some of us prone to this blazoning of embarrassment that is itself a cause for further embarrassment? Can you blush from sheer happiness, its flagrant touch on your skin? He was acquainted with the workings of the human body, but he knew no more about blushing than, apparently, Dr. Henderson had known. It wasn't his field. It was supposedly an affliction of the young and even innocent. Later, you got over it. Blushing like a girl or boy. But he knew that he himself could still go pink-faced for no obvious reason. Perhaps he was blushing now in his car, recalling the blushes of decades ago. Though, did you blush, it was a paradox, if no one could see you? And soon he would be concealing himself not just in a face mask, but in layers of protective clothing, all to spare his blushes? Was it the crumb in Mrs. Simmons' bosom, or the vexing question she had put to him? Was it the prospect that lay behind the question, and that had never so invitingly floated before his vision? That life itself might be a great choosing of girls. Girls! How delightful! What happiness! But if it was true, it was over now. The women of his life, and he himself might be near the end, for all the care he took with his protective gear. Near the end, and, so it seemed, near the beginning. 10. It was what they said happened when you drowned. You saw your whole life pass before you. And it was what the patients did in the unit when they reached the end. Effectively, they drowned. The hospital was now very close. He could see in the dip of the road its tall incinerator chimney and the spangle of lit-up windows in the not-yet-full April daylight. At any moment, he might be chased and overtaken by an ambulance with a quick blast of its siren. One morning, he'd been overtaken by 3. In a few minutes, he would have to switch off his memory, apply himself only to what was before him. He would have to turn off his life. How would this pandemic pan out? No one knew. He could only do what he could do for several uncountable hours in a place of great suffering and risk. Some of the staff were near to snapping, he could see. Psychiatry was not his field either, but he could see. They had homes and families to deal with, not just in their memories. They did not have empty mansions with automatic garage doors. A cheery colleague had said in one of their brief breaks that this was only a blip. The pandemic was a blip. It was just a great preliminary distraction from the real calamity, that the planet would be uninhabitable for human beings within a century, unless miracles were performed. He saw again in the shimmering ancient trees, watching like sentinels over the gardens. He saw the lawn. His father had mowed it, especially on the eve of his birthday. He saw the party frocks. He saw the wardrobe of illnesses so gallantly put on by little souls and then happily discarded. He saw Mrs. Sims, her bare shoulders. He saw his mother. And he saw himself lying in a bed just a week later, his mother leaning toward him and Dr. Henderson in his chair. It was because of Dr. Henderson, he was sure of it, that his mother had wanted him to become a doctor. The two of them had left his bedroom and gone downstairs for their cup of tea. He could hear only the murmur of their voices. No words. Grown-up conversation. Then Dr. Henderson had left. But he heard again now, his mother saying to Dr. Henderson in the striped chair, unless he's just blushing, though with that look that was meant for him, lying beneath the bedclothes. And so he knew, after Dr. Henderson had completed his diagnosis, that it must have been on his 10th birthday, at its wonderful birthday party, that he'd caught scarlet fever. And now, from the online version of the New Yorker magazine, September 8th, 2020, Is America a Myth? By Robin Wright. The United States feels like it is unraveling. It's not just because of a toxic election season, a national crisis over race, unemployment and hunger in the land of opportunity, or a pandemic that's killing tens of thousands every month. The foundation of our nation has deepening cracks, possibly too many to repair anytime soon, or perhaps at all. The ideas and imagery of America face existential challenges, some with reason, some without, that no longer come only from the fringes. Rage consumes many in America, and it may only get worse after the election, and for the next 4 years, no matter who wins. Our political and cultural fissions have generated growing doubt about the stability of a country that long considered itself an anchor, a model, and an exception to the rest of the world. Scholars, political scientists, and historians even posit that trying to unite disparate states, cultures, ethnic groups, and religions was always illusory. The idea that America has a shared past going back into the colonial period is a myth. Colin Woodard, the author of Union, The Struggle to Forge the Story of United Nations Nationhood, told me, "We are very different Americas, each with different origin stories and value sets, many of which are incompatible. They led to a civil war in the past and are a potentially incendiary force in the future." The crisis today reflects the nation's history. Not much, it turns out, has changed. The country was settled by diverse cultures, the Puritans in New England, the Dutch around New York City, the Scots-Irish dominating Appalachia, and English slave lords from Barbados and the West Indies in the Deep South. They were often rivals. Woodard noted, quote, "They were by no means thinking of themselves belonging to a protean American country in waiting. The United States was an accident of history," he said, "largely because distant cultures shared an external threat from the British. They formed the Continental Army to stage a revolution and formed the Continental Congress with delegates from 13 colonies. Almost 250 years later, a country six times its original size claims to be a melting pot that has produced an American culture and a political system that vows to provide life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Too often, it hasn't." Centuries later, the cultural divide and cleavages are still deep. 330 million people may identify as Americans, but they define what that means and what rights and responsibilities are involved in vastly different ways. The American promise has not delivered for many blacks, Jews, Latinos, Asian Americans, myriad immigrant groups, and even some whites as well. Hate crimes, acts of violence against people or property based on race, religion, disability, sexual orientation, ethnicity, or gender identity are a growing problem. A bipartisan group in the House warned in August that, as uncertainty rises, we have seen hatred unleashed. When Athens and Sparta went to war in the 5th century B.C., the Greek general and historian Thucydides observed, "The Greeks did not understand each other any longer, though they spoke the same language." In the 21st century, the same thing is happening among Americans. Our political discourse has become civil war by other means. We sound as if we do not really want to continue to be members of one country, Richard Kreitner wrote in the recently released book Break It Up, Secession, Division, and the Secret History of America's Imperfect Union. At different times in America's history, the Union's survival was produced as much by chance and contingency as by flag waving and political will. At nearly every step, it required morally indefensible compromises that only pushed problems further into the future. The attempt to reckon with our unjust past has produced more questions and new divisions about our future. In Washington, D.C. last week, a group commissioned by the city's mayor, Muriel Bowser, recommended in a report that her office ask the federal government to, quote, remove, relocate, or contextualize, end quote, the Washington Monument, the Jefferson Memorial, and statues to Benjamin Franklin and Christopher Columbus, among others. The committee compiled a list of people who should not have public works named after them, including Presidents James Monroe, Andrew Jackson, and Woodrow Wilson, the inventor Alexander Graham Bell, and Francis Scott Key, who wrote the national anthem. After a deluge of criticism, Bowser said on Friday that the report was being misinterpreted and that the city would not do anything about the monuments and memorials. But a question remains, not just because we live in the era of Black Lives Matter. What is America about today? And is it any different from its deeply flawed past? The crisis today reflects the nation's history. Not much, it turns out, has changed. The country was settled by diverse cultures, the Puritans in New England, the Dutch around New York City, the Scots-Irish dominating Appalachia, and English slave lords from Barbados and the West Indies in the Deep South. They were often rivals, Woodard noted. They were by no means thinking of themselves belonging to a protean American country in waiting. There was always the ambiguity about what the United States was supposed to be, Woodard said. Was it supposed to be an alliance of states, as the European Union with 27 distinct governments is today? Or a confederation, like Switzerland, with its 3 languages and 26 cantons? Or a nation-state, like post-revolutionary France? Or even a treaty mechanism to prevent interstate conflict? After the American Revolution, the ad hoc solution was to celebrate the shared victory against the British. Core differences were not addressed. Today, America is still conflicted about its values, whether over the social contract, the means of educating its children, the right to bear or ban arms, the protection of its vast lands, lakes, and air, or the relationship between the states and the federal government. Last week, Donald Trump threatened to withhold federal funds to 4 major cities, New York, Washington, Seattle, and Portland, because of anarchist activities during weeks of protest. Quote, my administration will not allow federal tax dollars to fund cities that allow themselves to deteriorate into lawless zones, end quote, the president's 5-page memo said. It was the latest of many acts by Trump that have further divided the nation, although the trend did not start with him. Since the 1830s, the United States has gone through cycles of crises that threatened its cohesion. The idea of a revolutionary republic committed to equality, at the time only for white men, started to erode as regional differences surfaced and the first generation of revolutionaries died out. States or territories have repeatedly pushed for independence. Vermont formally joined the Union in 1791 after spending 14 years as an independent republic. The state of Muskogee, a multicultural republic of Native Americans, escaped slaves, and white settlers around Tallahassee, lasted from 1799 until 1803. In 1810, a small group of settlers captured a Spanish fort in Baton Rouge and declared the creation of an independent Republic of West Florida. Their capital was St. Francisville, Louisiana. They elected a president, wrote a constitution, and designed a flag, a white star in blue. The movement died after President Monroe annexed the region. There were others, including the Republic of Fredonia, in Texas, the California Republic, and the Indian Stream Republic in New England. The biggest rupture, of course, was in the 1860s when 11 states, Texas, Arkansas, Louisiana, Tennessee, Mississippi, Alabama, Georgia, Florida, South Carolina, North Carolina, and Virginia, seceded to form the Confederacy. Wide divisions again threatened to cause a breakup of the nation in the 1930s, the 1960s, and now again, the Yale historian David Blight told me. Today, America is littered with prideful secessionist movements. Mirroring Brexit, Britain's exit from the European Union, they advocate for Texit from Texas, Collexit from California, and Verexit from Vermont. In 2017, a Vermont poll found that more than 20% of Vermonters believe that the state should consider peacefully leaving the United States and becoming an independent republic, as it was from 1777 to 1791. The Texas Nationalist Movement, which claims hundreds of thousands of members, is demanding a state referendum on secession. Then there's the more fanciful proposal of Cascadia, a progressive bio-republic carved out of Northern California, Oregon, Washington, and the Canadian provinces of British Columbia and Alberta. The trend is bipartisan and transregional. Secessionist sentiment has even emerged in the last 2 states to join the Union, Alaska and Hawaii. The need for internal trade and the dangers of external threats have helped hold America together. Disparate factions throughout the country rallied to counter British aggression in the 18th and 19th centuries, the Germans and the Japanese in the 20th, and Al-Qaeda after the 9/11 attacks in the 21st. But now, without outside threats, the nation is increasingly turning on itself. "We are definitely not united," Blight said. "Are we on the brink of secession of some kind?" "No, not in a sectional sense, but in the interior of our minds and communities, we are already in a period of slow evolving secession, in ways that are deeper than ideology and political beliefs. We are tribes with at least two or more sources of information, facts, narratives, and stories we live in. The United States today," Blight said, "is a house divided about what holds the house up." In his new book, Kreitner argues that, with its politics irrevocably broken, America is running out of time. The potential for physical and political separation is now real, even though the polarization of America does not have neat geographic borders. No red state is entirely red. No blue state is entirely blue. The 21st century has seen an unmistakable resurgence of the idea of leaving or breaking up the United States, a kaleidoscope array of separatist movements shaped by the conflicts and divisions of the past, but manifested in new and potentially destabilizing ways, he writes. Unlike in the past, the current separatist impulses have emerged in multiple places at the same time. Often dismissed as unserious or chaotic, a throwback to the Confederacy, the new secessionism reveals divisions in American life possibly no less intractable than the ones that led to the first Civil War, Kreitner warns. In the years to come, the appeal of pulling the plug on the American experiment is likely to grow, even among faithful adherents to the idea of federal power. And if the Union dissolves again, Kreitner writes, it will not be along a clean line, but everywhere and all at once. In some ways, the election now, only 8 weeks away, will be a temporary relief, at least in ending the current agonizing uncertainty. But it will play only one part in deciding what ultimately will happen to our nation. Are we a myth? Well, yes, in the deep sense. Always have been, Blight said. To survive, America must move beyond the myth. Next, from the current cinema section of the January 25th, 2021 edition of the New Yorker magazine, Surveillance, MLK FBI, and Preparations to Be Together for an Unknown Period of Time, by Anthony Lane. In the late 1950s, James Stewart was on a roll. Vertigo came out in 1958, as did the sly and funny Bell Book and Candle, followed by Anatomy of a Murder in 1959. A decorated veteran and a loyal Republican, Stewart seemed at once trusty and perplexed. Still a straight arrow, but no longer sure in the post-war world of where exactly he was aimed. Yet to come was The Man Who Shot Liberty Valance, 1962, in which he and John Wayne duke it out for the values of the Old West. Was it perhaps Stewart's wish to prove himself steadfast in spite of change that impelled him to star in The FBI Story in 1959? It runs 2.5 hours, growls at irony and doubt, and features a cameo by J. Edgar Hoover, the director of the Bureau from 1924 to 1972. Stewart plays a longtime G-man whose creed is nicely distilled in this report on a concurrent suspect. It reads, "On Sunday morning he left the house. He couldn't be going to work. Since he was a communist, we knew he wasn't going to church." So that's clear enough, though it raises a question. If you go to church, or if you preach at a church, does that prove that you can't be a communist? Scenes from the FBI Story and from other films and TV shows are used as evidence in MLK FBI, a new documentary directed by Sam Pollard, which investigates the investigators in the age of Hoover. Specifically, with the aid of declassified documents, Pollard explores the Bureau's campaign to spy on the Reverend Martin Luther King, Jr., to record his words and deeds, and given the chance to wield them against him. As an internal FBI memo read, "We must mark him now as the most dangerous Negro in the future of this nation." That was written at the end of August 1963, only days after King, a long-standing anti-communist as it happens, spoke at the conclusion of the March on Washington. "Free at last," he exclaimed, whereupon the secret fetters were applied. Of particular interest to the Bureau was King's close associate, Stanley Levison, who had formerly harbored communist sympathies and, as treasurer in the American Jewish Congress, had supported the defense of the Rosenbergs. On the strength of such weak links, Robert Kennedy, the Attorney General, was asked to approve the covert wiretapping of King, whom he openly admired. Kennedy complied. If you wince at such revelations, get ready. There is more wincing to come, and Pollard forbids you to relax. The movie doesn't stop for talking heads. Commentary is supplied in voiceover with the speakers' names, Clarence Jones, say, or Beverly Gage, placed at the foot of the screen. Should this be your field, you will know that Jones was one of King's lawyers. It was he who smuggled out the loose sheets of King's writing that would form the basis of Letter from Birmingham Jail in 1963, and that Gage, a professor of history at Yale, is an expert on Hoover. We lesser mortals must wait until the end of the film to be enlightened. In short, MLK FBI has a yen for narrative momentum, and you can see why. Pollard wants to capture not just the crusading urgency of King, who acted as if all too aware that his days were numbered, but the corresponding compulsions of Hoover, who publicly referred to King as the world's most notorious liar. Once the wiretaps had uncovered King's marital infidelities, the scrutiny of him acquired an excitable life of its own, far exceeding the original brief and reaching its vengeful extreme in the tapes that were sent to King's wife, together with a letter addressed to King. Though anonymous, the letter was, in fact, composed by William Sullivan, the head of domestic intelligence at the FBI, and capped with a vague but menacing caution, "You know what you have to do." The most contentious detail in the film is the accusation made in a typed FBI report that King was present when a female parishioner was raped in a hotel room by a Baptist minister in 1964. A scribbled note was added to the report. King looked on and laughed and offered advice. The note read, "As one of the movie's contributors points out, this is profoundly flawed as testimony. How could anyone determine from an audio tape that King looked on? Might it be that the addendum, disclosed in 2019 by David Garrow, whose biography of King won a Pulitzer Prize and who appears in MLK FBI, is more scurrility? And if so, why lend it any credence or air it afresh on film? On the other hand, if the Bureau was making grave and deliberate mischief, is that not part of the historical record? Sullivan described the allegation as a golden opportunity to discredit King because of his communist connections and moral degeneracy. So much for gold. Further clarity will not be available until 2027, when the surreptitious tapes of King's activities are unsealed, and this documentary, however dramatic its mood, is in a sense a prequel. Many people are confident that no damage will be done to King's reputation as a result of the unsealing, although one retired FBI agent, interviewed by Pollard, believes that the tapes should stay in the dark. Viewers who find these quandaries depressing or distasteful should persevere with MLK FBI nonetheless, for three reasons. First, it bears renewed witness to King's eloquence, which is no less astounding in casual exchanges than on grand occasions. One interviewer is treated to a calm, impromptu diatribe against the thingification of the Negro in slavery's wake. Second, we are reminded by Garrow and Gage of an awkward truth that Hoover's FBI was not some rogue outfit, but a core component of the existing social structure welded firmly to public opinion. Hence the movie's clips from the popular culture, which tends both to mirror and to magnify the prejudices and dreads of any given period. I was inspired by Pollard's findings to watch I Was a Communist for the FBI, 1951, a feature film of more punch than subtlety, in which a largely African-American audience in a Pittsburgh meeting hall is roused by what the narrator calls, quote, a hell brew of hate from a recipe written in the Kremlin, end quote. Third and last, we have Ernest C. Withers, a minor tributary of the movie. You might say, yet almost as fascinating as the main flow. One of the leading black photographers of his time, Withers took a memorable picture of King and others as they rode one of the first desegregated buses in Montgomery, Alabama in 1956. In MLK FBI, we are shown a wonderful image of Withers posed against his station wagon in striped pants with his foldable camera and flash. We are also told that for 18 years he was an FBI informant at the heart of the civil rights movement. And that, with all due respect to James Stewart, is the FBI story I want to see. But we have time for a cartoon or two. In the first cartoon, a couple is watching TV in their living room. And the woman says to the man, "The following contains scenes of people not accepting thing what they cannot change. Viewer discretion is advised." Excuse me, the TV said that, not the woman. In the next cartoon, a husband and wife in their pajamas are sitting on the edge of the bed, and the wife says, "You can't sleep? Have you tried meditating, then reading for an hour, then going to the couch, and then back to the bed, and then counting backward from 10 million, and then taking a sleeping pill?" Well, we've run out of time for today's episode of The New Yorker. I hope you enjoyed it and that you'll be sure and listen next time. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and/or print impaired. The New Yorker readings are available as podcasts at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Well, thank you so much for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service today. This is Evan Mercer. So long, everybody.